Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon, although we could see wind gusts up to 40 miles an hour at some point. High today is supposed to reach 80 degrees. 85 is average for today. We hit 89 yesterday. Clear skies, windy conditions tonight with overnight lows in the mid-50s. And then pretty much the same for the weekend as we see today. Sunny skies, a high of 80 tomorrow, 82 on Sunday. Right now, under mostly sunny skies, it's 78 degrees at KJZZ. Supporters of an initiative to legalize marijuana for recreational use in Arizona say they've already gathered more than enough of the necessary signatures for it to appear on November's ballot. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, the group says it's also been successful in signing up thousands of new prospective voters.
The campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol in Arizona has collected more than 200,000 signatures. That's about 50,000 more than is required, but still not enough.
You know, we're going to get more than 225,000, a pretty significant cushion to make sure that we do qualify for the ballot.
Campaign spokesman Barrett Marson says it's because they know many will be invalidated if signees aren't registered voters. And as far as that's concerned,
quite frankly, we are actually registering thousands of new voters through this effort.
The group has hired professional verifiers to ensure they'll have enough valid names by the July deadline for the initiative to appear on the November ballot. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
It appears state legislators will not make any changes to Arizona's civil asset forfeiture laws this year. There were a few proposals introduced, including one that would have set up a study committee on the issue. Jay Kabu is a partner in the White Collar and Investigations Group at the law firm Perkins Coie. He supports changes to the state system. And Jay, what do you think about the fact it looks like lawmakers will not make any changes this year?
Look, I think that the fact that the legislature will not pass a bill on civil asset forfeiture is disappointing. And I think especially in an area where there's so much bipartisan agreement that reform is necessary, it is particularly frustrating for those of us who have worked hard to reach across the aisle to a wide variety of traditionally adversarial constituencies to form a coalition to get something done, especially at a time both locally and nationally when it's hard to get something done politically. That said, I think the legislators that have taken up this issue, they're to be commended. And, you know, the fact that we didn't get a bill passed this session is frustrating. But I think that the fact that there is actual progress being made and that there's testimony being given and that there's a conversation going on is a step in the right direction. And that's wonderful.
So you're sort of taking the long view of this, that you start the conversation this year, maybe next year you make a little more progress.
Absolutely. These are laws that have been on the books for three decades. Relatively unchanged. Any of the changes that have been made have been to make it easier for law enforcement to forfeit money. So I think this is an important first step towards reform. It's part of a national movement on civil asset forfeiture reform.
Obviously, the legislature is the only way to change laws in this state, but are there other ways that advocates for this kind of reform can sort of go about laying more groundwork?
Sure. And I think that advocates who are working on this issue on civil asset forfeiture reform in Arizona are doing that. One thing that is going on is there's an ongoing conversation. I know the legislative session is winding down, but conversations are ongoing. And my hope is that with the benefit of the session winding down, those conversations will continue. And they'll continue through the summer and into next year and into next session, where hopefully we can have, you know, an even broader group of people from the various constituencies involved, including law enforcement, involved in a real good faith effort to get this law changed.
Is there one particular aspect of the law that you think is more pressing to change than others?
You know, speaking just personally, and I think if you talk to the other organizations and people involved in the reform movement, they may have a different take on this. But my own sense is that the overall profit incentive that is infused into Arizona's law and that of other states, but as my colleagues from Institute for Justice have said, the policing for profit incentive is a particularly pernicious part of our state's law. The fact that there is a direct pipeline from the seizing officer to the spending of that money by that officer's agency is a huge problem. It creates tremendous incentives that really shouldn't be any part of law enforcement.
Jay Kabu is a partner in the White Collar and Investigations Group at the law firm Perkins Coie. Arizona prosecutors generally opposed the bills that would have changed the state's civil asset forfeiture laws. For more on that, I'm joined by Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery. And Bill, do you think the laws need to be addressed?
Well, our current asset forfeiture laws work just fine. In fact, one of my issues with efforts to try to change the laws is that I haven't seen a problem definition that states where the laws are falling short and where they're failing to address any issues of concern that have arisen in the community.
What do you make of the concerns that some attorneys and the Goldwater Institute have raised about where some of these resources are being spent?
Well, and let's keep in mind, too, that there are two parts to this. One is the asset forfeiture process itself, and then the second part to it, and which you could say is the other side of the same coin, is how funds that are retained by law enforcement are spent. And in terms of expenditures, I haven't seen yet where someone has been able to say that the laws that we have right now do not provide a proper means for identifying impermissible expenditures and how to address them.
So in your mind, then, if there is some of that going on, is it just a matter of not enforcing current law?
Well, it could be not enforcing current law or not holding public officials accountable where expenditures are impermissible. That's where I would focus first.
I'm curious about one of the proposals that prosecutors didn't support at the Capitol this year, which was forming this study committee to look at asset forfeiture laws. I'm wondering, what's the harm in just looking at it? What's the harm in setting up a study committee? And if nothing comes of it, nothing comes of it, but at least you give it a look.
Well, first and foremost, prosecutors weren't invited to be part of the process to discuss the need for a study committee in the first instance. The legislature that was introduced down at the Capitol completely bypassed law enforcement. So the entire process itself was disingenuous in terms of involving law enforcement up front in the conversation.
Do you think that there is a way to craft a tweak to the law, if one is going to happen, that would allow, you know, prosecutors and other law enforcement to go after drug cartels and criminal gangs and folks like that, while also maybe strengthening protections for people who get caught up in problems maybe with their family members or people who are not involved in a criminal enterprise who have assets seized?
Oh, yeah. In fact, Mark, there were several areas identified by prosecutors in particular that, you know, here's some areas in the statute that we could take a look at that would help address concerns that people have about the process itself, but would also, you know, honor the real intent of the statutes and how they're actually used.
Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery. Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
It's the show for Friday, April 15th. Thanks for listening. Along with the Takeaways, John Hockenberry today, I'm Mark Brody. It was a battle of cheering fans last night at the Brooklyn Navy Yard for the Democratic debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Millennials are an earth-shaking demographic in marketing, media, fashion, and technology. But young people coming of age on the other side of Bill Clinton's bridge to the 21st century may not be so important as voters.
Does the youthful message of Bernie Sanders bring millennials to the 2016 contest as a crucial constituency? Does being a woman help Hillary Clinton excite younger women voters? In all elections, young people vote at lower rates of participation than older voters, and a new poll released this week from ABC News and Refinery29, it found that of women between the ages of 18 and 35, only 58% were certain they would vote in this presidential election. Neha Gandhi is Senior Vice President of Content Strategy and Innovation for Refinery29, and Cleo Chang is a writer who appears in The New Republic and the Century Foundation, a progressive policy think tank. Neither of them found last night's debate particularly inspiring.
It started to feel so snippy. We're hearing the same things from the candidates in a lot of ways, and that conversation wasn't changing, but the tone had changed so much.
Weariness. Cleo, how about you?
Yeah, I would agree. I feel like I heard some of the same issues brought up again and again, and nothing was really changing, and they were getting much more adversarial.
And, you know, a cynicism and a skepticism of the political system in general is a feature of millennial voters of all kinds. But let's take a look at this ABC News and Refinery29 poll on women between the ages of 18 and 35. But Neha, what does that tell you about the way it's breaking down for this group, critical group of voters?
I mean, there are some really interesting things we saw specifically in terms of how this group is going to vote. They're largely Bernie Sanders supporters. 35% of the women we spoke to are in favor of a Bernie Sanders presidency. But the part that's probably the most interesting is when you look at feminist voters. They are largely in favor of Sanders, and much more so than Clinton. The only place where you see them sort of even is actually when you look at women who don't identify as feminist, 24% Sanders, 24% Clinton, and then 27% GOP.
Why doesn't Hillary seem to get, Cleo, a credential as a feminist pioneer in any way? Because she's certainly fought some battles.
Right, definitely. I think that young women can see that, but they may not relate to Hillary in the same way that older generations might. Hillary's of a different generation, and she's, you know, while she's running on a more progressive policy than her husband did in the past, I think they're, you know, more attracted to the policies that Bernie is bringing to the table.
What is it about, I mean, because Bernie's not anywhere close to the millennial generation, is it Bernie makes the traditional workplace boss nervous with his economic policies, so that sort of shaking everything up idea makes these women more comfortable? Because, you know, you don't get the sense that Bernie has a natural voice to young women, per se. Neha?
I think it's two things. There's one, there's this idea of big ideas. The people that are most interesting to me are the ones who are like, well, I'm going to either vote for Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump because they have big ideas. And there's this feeling that it doesn't matter what the big idea is. But the other part is that I think Bernie Sanders, from the beginning, has been talking about the issue that is most important to millennials in general, whether they're men or women, and that is income inequality. That's been his platform. And he has real authority and credibility there with them, especially when they're younger and they're paying less in taxes.
Cleo, even though Hillary has, you know, campaigned on income equality between women and men for decades?
I mean, I think that if young women are looking at the policies that they're putting out now, you know, Bernie is certainly more progressive, and he is fighting the income inequality battle in ways that Hillary is not. So I think for young women who are poorer in more fragile economic situations, it definitely makes sense.
Why would young women be more interested in the kind of class struggle framing of the income inequality argument, as Bernie Sanders does, than as a feminist question, as Hillary Clinton does?
I actually look at those as two different things. When we polled this audience, we saw 21% of them said income inequality is the issue for me, and then another 11% said equal pay for women. And I think that that comes from sort of their economic status. Millennials in general are, you know, 25% of them are living paycheck to paycheck. Or actually, I think the number's actually bigger than that. I think 25% of them are living below the poverty line. So this idea of the 1% is really sort of appealing to them. They can feel like a common enemy, I think, to a lot of younger voters in a way where you bifurcate the vote when you're looking at equal pay for men versus women.
Do you think millennials have this idea that they want their vote to upset the system, and that's an attraction to Bernie's candidacy and the Trump candidacy, Cleo?
I think definitely. We've been just seeing a lot of political gridlock over the past couple of years, and you know, I think a lot of millennials, this is the time that they're most politically, you know, growing into their political awareness. And that's definitely a huge issue that disillusions them with the idea of the same old, same old.
Do you think big ideas is the way this campaign is going to go? I mean, we heard both of you saying that it sounded like they were just sniping at each other in the debate. Where do you see the big ideas maybe coming back to the center stage in this campaign?
I mean, this may sound a little cynical, but I actually don't know if big ideas is going to be the story of the general. I think likely it will be Clinton versus Trump, Cruz, let's see. But I think that what's really going to get a lot of people out to vote is a little bit of fear. I mean, when we talk to these women, there is this feeling that they're not inspired by the candidates. I think that there's some inspiration around big ideas, but when you look at the numbers, 47% of women told us that they don't find any of the candidates inspiring. There's an even larger number that says, no thanks, I wouldn't want to have dinner with any of them given the opportunity. I think that there is this disillusionment there. And if they turn out, it's likely going to be out of fear of something like a Donald Trump presidency.
Neha Gandhi is Senior Vice President of Content Strategy and Innovation for Refinery29, an independent lifestyle website. And Cleo Chang is a writer whose work has been featured in The New Republic and The Century Foundation, a progressive policy think tank.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
Tomorrow, more than 20,000 people will be at Chase Field, not for a baseball game, but for healthcare and other services. An annual event called Hope Fest aims to serve the needs of uninsured or underinsured people by giving medical care and referring them to long-term services. The show's Annika Klein went to Chase Field as the volunteers were setting up this morning.
The Legend Suites in Chase Field offer one of the best bird's-eye views of the diamond. But today, most of the people in here are looking into other people's mouths.
Eventually, head back for me. I'm just going to take a peek, okay?
The suites are full of dentists. While volunteers set up for Hope Fest in other areas, the dentists are already getting down to the enamel. They improvise with what they have out of travel dental kits, treating patients who may not have been to a dentist in a very long time.
All right, I'm going to use an instrument that sprays some water, okay?
While a line of patients already fills the waiting area. It'll be like this, nonstop, through Hope Fest.
Yeah, the need is huge here.
Marcy Gill is a hygienist from an office in the West Valley and a return volunteer.
We have a lot of emergency cases here, so sometimes it's pick and choose what is the most dire need of the patient at the time. So we kind of try to help them with whatever's most important and may give them trouble soon.
But they still probably won't see everyone who needs this service.
That's why Hope Fest tries to connect people to long-term care, too. To talk more about the event, I'm joined by co-founder Billy Thrall. And Billy, tell me what's going on at the ballpark.
Well, today is primarily setup day because the main event is on Saturday. And so today the dental is setting up and there are hundreds and hundreds of volunteers getting ready. The day of the event, we have over 20,000 people show up for everything, vision, medical, dental, haircuts, groceries, you name it. So we turn Chase Field into like a festival of care, I guess is the best way to describe it. And anyone can come. Mostly we bump into folks who may be struggling, the working poor who needed something. And so we hope to provide whatever they need here at one place.
How do you let those folks know about this event going on? I mean, And I ask because in a lot of ways, this is traditionally and maybe stereotypically a very difficult population to reach.
Yes. I usually answer that question by saying most people who are suffering and can't make ends meet live in a lot of fear. So they don't get treated for whatever they might have. They don't know where to go. They're afraid to admit they have something wrong with them. And they're struggling with poverty, so they don't have resource to kind of cover a mistake that they might make in their life. So one of the things that we do is we advertise or we promote this event anywhere who currently meets that need in our city or in our state. In other words, where are there state providers, city providers, nonprofits caring for the working poor? We promote this event in their offices and through their networks.
What is the advantage in your mind of having sort of a one-stop shop where folks can come and get all kinds of services?
Anybody who does anything to serve people, we have them here. Because we're never quite sure what the guest is going to need. And actually, many, many times, somebody comes to Hope Fest, for example, thinking, oh, okay, I'll get a haircut. And then they bump into housing services. Or they didn't realize that, oh, there's something here for care for their elder parents. Some of the most amazing stories are, we had a woman last year, three kids, toward the end of the day, she showed up and she'd been told that maybe she could get some help because she was leaving a domestic violence situation that night. And in a lot of tears and with trembling, she bumped into one of our friends who happens to be a pastor in town, and he goes, hey, let's take you over to this housing thing. And they put her in a 6-month location, and then she got connected to a domestic violence recovery shelter. So she didn't come knowing that was available here. But our goal is that anybody who comes with any need will find what they need, hopefully, prayerfully, all in one spot.
What kinds of services have you added since over the years since you first started 5 years ago?
We've expanded the dental. We realize that because access doesn't cover dental, and most of the times that's a real suffering point for the poor, we've actually gotten a lot better, too, at sort of streamlining our care and putting the agencies who do the same thing near each other So we've gotten a lot better at making it feel like it makes sense. We've also made the front of Chase, we want it to feel like a festival, not something that they have to be scared to attend. So we've expanded what goes on outside, really trying to make sure that this fragile person, this fragile family feels honored when they show up.
Billy Thrall is a co-founder of Hope Fest Phoenix. It will be taking place at Chase Field tomorrow. The doors will be opened between 9 and 2. Billy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kids as young as 12 are getting pulled into Valley gangs, and once they're in, it can be nearly impossible to get them out, says the Phoenix Police Department's Gang Enforcement Unit. But one gym in Phoenix is working to give out at-risk kids another option. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger hit the ring to find out more.
All right, on the bell.
Coach Pete Chavez straps on his gloves, puts in a mouth guard with fangs painted on it, and touches gloves with a teenager in his class. They nod at each other, then they start sparring. On this afternoon, there are about 20 kids and teenagers jabbing at punching bags and practicing their footwork in Chavez's gym on 24th Street and Oak in Phoenix.
Don't go through the motions. Get your jab out right, strong.
They're part of the Chavez Boxing Foundation's youth prevention program. It aims to keep kids off the streets and in the ring.
Because when I was young, and then I was like just as bad as kids, worse than a lot of them, you know? Grew up over here at 35th and Van Buren, so.
Chavez says he wasn't a bad kid. That was just all he knew.
You know, gangs, every corner you turn, there's a gang. 35th, Wedgwood, this and that, so.
When he was 14, he got in a fight after a football game and won.
And a guy gave me his card, like, hey, you got really good hands, like a boxer.
But his first round in the ring, he learned he wasn't as tough as he thought.
And the first time I sparred, you know, a guy smaller than me, no muscle tone, nothing, beat the crap out of me, and I'm like, oh.
So he worked and got better.
Once I did really well, I started, like, you know, having one fight, and amateurs, you don't have knockouts because it's only three rounds, headgear, but I would have my first fight knockout, my second fight knockout, my third fight knockout, and on, I'm like, wow.
Boxing made him strong and realize his power.
That's the really cool part, like, people would sell me drugs or try to do this and that, and I'm like, no, I don't do that, or I don't like whatever, you know, because it was in the neighborhood, and then, like, other guys from gangs and stuff, they were like, even stick up for me, though, so I'm like, no, he's going to be our next champion, leave this guy alone.
Ready?
Ready.
All right, Sergeant. 1, 2.
I really saw this as an opportunity for us to really address the gang issue on the front end instead of trying to fix something when they're already involved and embedded in that gang lifestyle.
Sergeant Chris Eric has been in the Phoenix Police Department's gang enforcement unit for the last 3 years.
That's 3. All right. Let's coach.
Before that, he spent the last 2 decades working in South Central LA and then South Phoenix.
Yes, we have shootings, stabbings, we have gang threats. So it's just this sense of they steal the community from the people that live in it.
He says there are 2 ways people say they get caught up in gangs. They were born in, or
they were jumped in, which means for a certain amount of time, people who are already in the gang, the other gang members, will beat them up. So if they're like, say, from a 21st Street gang, they'll have to survive for 21 seconds getting beaten up by 4 or 5 or 6 other gang members.
And this can start around age 12. So when Eric saw a video on Facebook about the Chavez Boxing Foundation, he knew he had to get involved.
They have to be here a certain time, they can't miss. So it gives these kids, even though it seems like they're being hard on them, they love it. They love that they have to be somewhere, they have to be responsible.
He got the foundation added to the city of Phoenix's community service fund drive so city employees can donate to it directly from their paychecks.
Don't stop on the last one. Come all the way up, too.
And he's working with the gym on gang resistance education for these kids.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Chavez says out of the 6 guys he grew up with in the gym, only 2 of them made it out.
2 of them committed suicide, you know. 1 got killed, drunk driver, you know, partying, doing this and that. Another one, you know, armed robbery, ended up in prison, attempted murder.
That's why he tells these kids boxing saves lives, because he thinks it saved his.
I hated my home life. I hated my life, period. So with the ring, like at boxing, that was like our haven. We were only there 3 days a week, but on off days, I would go work out with them. I would go run. We would spar. So, you know, it like literally, like it was my motivation, my sanctuary, and I loved it, you know.
In Phoenix, Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
Today, the baseball world remembers the legendary Jackie Robinson and his incredible accomplishments in the face of discrimination across the country. Long before he broke baseball's color barrier with the Dodgers, an incident in Phoenix as a young football player helped shape the icon's future. From the Cronkite News Service, here's Torrance Dunham.
69 years ago today, Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball when he made his debut with the Brooklyn Dodgers. But 10 years before that, Robinson was a junior college football player, getting ready to take on Phoenix Junior College. It was on that trip to Phoenix that he got one of his first tastes of discrimination as an athlete.
Jackie Robinson was playing football for Pasadena Junior College in California, and it was an integrated team.
Jacob Pomeranke is a baseball historian with the Society for American Baseball Research in Phoenix.
They came to Phoenix for a game, and the hotel, the team hotel that they were trying to stay at in downtown Phoenix, refused to house the black players for the night. And so Jackie and his black teammates had to go to a boarding house in downtown Phoenix, and that's where they had to stay the night and play their next game. It definitely was an insult, to get kicked out of a hotel like the Westward Ho or the Adams Hotel in downtown Phoenix. These were prestigious addresses that civic leaders and politicians would stay at when they came through, but to be shuffled off to a boarding house or to a host family when you're traveling through, you know, definitely made people feel like second-class citizens.
Just one of the buildings that was used as an African-American boarding house during the era of segregation is left standing in the city today, the Swindell Tourist Inn on East Washington Street, which is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The building now houses professional offices. Former Phoenix City Councilman Calvin Good, who himself faced discrimination growing up in Arizona, believes the building serves as an important reminder of the past challenges faced by African Americans in the Valley during segregation.
It's extremely important to recognize the fact that we had that kind of a situation existing in a country that say liberty and justice and freedom for all, and then to discriminate because of the color of our skin. Certainly people needed a place to live, to stay, and certainly I thought it did provide a service at that time. I'm very pleased that someone was able to purchase a building and is keeping it in existence.
As part of the Jackie Robinson Day celebrations across Major League Baseball today, all players will wear Robinson's number 42. In Phoenix, I'm Torrance Dunham.
Torrance's story comes to us from our partners at the Cronkite News Service at ASU. What does it mean to sustain a career in the gig economy? That's the question asked by Stephen Tepper in a new article. He's dean of the Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts at ASU and wonders about how workers will do when they move from job to job as opposed to having one steady employer. Tepper joins me to talk about this. And Stephen, why write the piece in the first place?
We need to have a robust conversation about how you sustain a career as an artist. And I'm an optimist. Artists are just part of a very dynamic economy that's changing, and in some ways they've been the sort of canary in the mine of this economy. They've been working this way for a long time. And so for me, this is really a piece I wanted to write to lay out some issues and to really move a positive, productive conversation about what meaningful work can look like in the 21st century.
Well, as you say, artists have been kind of working like this for a long time, perhaps more so than other types of jobs. What has changed over the last maybe 5 or 10 years from the way that artists in some ways have sort of always been working?
Yeah, so it hasn't changed so much for artists. It's changed for the rest of the economy. So we talk about these changes as a gig economy. So this is a reality of life in the post-industrial economy. And the bright side of that is that people are kind of driving their own careers. It's a world of enterprise. And so artists have largely worked that way since Michelangelo was bumping around from commission to commission.
Does it in some ways help artists that other sectors of the economy are sort of working in this same way now and seeing how it is that artists have been working?
I think it does. I think it's been easy to sort of disregard the plight of the artist because we romanticize the bohemian artist who's willing to do their work at any cost, including the cost of not working at a living wage. In fact, in some ways, the mythology of the starving artist has validated work in the arts, that if the artist is outside of the market, not making money at it, it must be more authentic, it must be more true. And that's simply not a helpful mythology. So I think what's going to help artists as the rest of the economy has leaned towards them is that more and more people, more and more activists are organizing around what it means to be a worker in the 21st century and how can independent and contract workers not suffer the slings and arrows of irregular work. Because, well, their work may be irregular, their needs as humans are regular.
One of the suggestions that you put forth is to train artists in entrepreneurship and business. And it strikes me that that would probably be a good lesson for all of us, not just artists.
Well, that's right. Again, this is a case where artists are sort of maybe at the leading edge. But, you know, I've surveyed more than 140,000 arts graduates and design graduates across America. And there is this significant, what we call skills gap between what artists say they need once they're out in the world and what they say they got in school. And the area where that gap is the largest is around entrepreneurship, basic business management skills.
Like how to make it.
How to make it, how to market, how to finance your work, how to write a contract, understanding intellectual property. You know, those are skill sets that artists are having to learn on their own. And, you know, and many never quite do.
Well, you are somebody who runs an institution that puts a lot of artists into the world every year. Are these easy things to incorporate into the curriculum, or is it a kind of a challenge to find time for them, number
right.
one, and number two, convince students that they need to know this stuff?
It's a challenge, and part of the reason it's a challenge is because if artists are going to succeed in the world, they have got to be unbelievably compelling in the work they do, which means they've got to be steeped in their discipline and craft. So our curriculum is organized around giving musicians and performers and dancers and designers so much time in the studio perfecting what they do. And that's where the tension is, that our faculty and even the students don't want to give that time up. It's precious time. But on the other hand, there's got to be a balancing act. I think students are less resistant than probably those of us who are leading and teaching in design and art schools. But again, we're not preparing them for the actual world they're going to live in. So we can create this sort of snow globe of an environment, and we shake it up, and it seems like a perfect setting. But you know, ultimately what, you know, that's not the reality of the world they're going to live in, and that's what we have to align ourselves better.
Stephen Temper is dean of the Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts at ASU. We'll link to his article at theshow.kjzz.org. Yesterday's science fiction plot is often today's potential medical advance. For example, there's pioneering research into neuroscience in Great Britain. Researchers are growing mini versions of human brains to find out more about different types of mental illness and how they could be treated. The BBC's Fergus Walsh has the story.
In my hands, I'm holding half a brain, the right hemisphere of one of the hundreds of brains donated for medical research in the UK every year. And if I carefully run my fingers across its grooves and ridges, it's really a reminder of just how fragile the brain is, and yet how powerful. It is a biological masterpiece, and yet despite all our scientific knowledge, there's still a huge amount we've still got to learn about how the brain works and why sometimes it goes wrong. But the brain is beginning to give up its secrets. Advances in biology mean many genes implicated in mental illness have been identified. And new scanning techniques are creating something extraordinary, a complete map of the brain's intricate network of connections.
So this is an MRI scan of the human brain. It's a scan that's been designed to show the cabling of the brain.
Professor Ed Bulmore is head of psychiatry at the University of Cambridge. He showed me an image made up of thousands of brightly coloured spaghetti-like wires. These represent bundles of nerve fibres linking different parts of the brain through a number of highly connected hubs.
So you can think about it by comparison to an airline network. You know, we know that different airports around the world have different numbers of flights. And an airport like Heathrow, for example, is a hub of the airline network.
Researchers have found that people with schizophrenia tend to have fewer hubs, so their brain networks are less well connected than healthy individuals.
Where the excitement is building at the moment is linking the network diagrams that we can get out of imaging to what we're learning about the genetics of schizophrenia. If we can bring those two things together, then we may be able to understand more clearly what are the mechanisms, the genetic mechanisms that drive network development to go off on a somewhat different path that leads to schizophrenia. And if we can understand mechanisms, then we can design new treatments.
I'm on my way to the Medical Research Council Laboratory of Molecular Biology, just down the road in Cambridge, to discuss a very different aspect of neuroscience. And I confess I'm pretty excited, as I'm going to see something very unusual. Dozens of miniature human brains, known as organoids.
If we open up the incubator here, you'll see all of our conical flasks. And inside of each is the nutrient mixture that these organoids grow in, which keeps them at a very nice, warm 37 degrees, so body temperature.
Their creator is Madeline Lancaster, who invented the technique. These round clumps of tissue mimic what the early fetal brain is like in the womb. Each was grown from a single cell donated by a patient. In those with mental illness, their mini brains can help explore the origins of their disorder.
These organoids really have the potential to provide us with insight into what are the events that lead up to the defects that happen in mental health illnesses. Questions about how our brain functions just simply can't be answered in animal models. And so these types of technologies, where we're really looking at human tissue, will hopefully give us some new insight.
So when will this research pay dividends in delivering new medications for mental illness? Professor Shitich Kapoor is Dean of the Institute of Psychiatry at King's College London.
In the next 5 to 10 years, you can expect two things with reasonable certainty. One, we'll be able to use neuroscience and genetics to target treatments better to patients. And this could happen in schizophrenia. The second is that based on the knowledge we have now, we could actually have new medications, not for an entire illness, but for a subset of it.
Of course, our mental health is determined by our life experiences, as well as the genes we inherit. The more we discover about the brain, this pinnacle of evolution, the greater the chance we have of treating it when it goes wrong.
That's the BBC's Fergus Walsh. The Arizona and Maricopa County Departments of Transportation are working with researchers at the University of Arizona on new connected vehicle technology. The testing in Anthem deals in part of a national effort to develop safety systems for autos, in which they can talk to each other and share information about where they're going and where they are. Larry Head, a professor of systems and industrial engineering at U of A, is part of the group working on this, and he joins me. So, Larry, how exactly does it work?
It's kind of the equivalent of the Internet of Things safety belts, if you will. So they're going to add safety systems to cars using this vehicle-to-vehicle communication. But since the vehicles are talking to each other, we can listen in the infrastructure and say, oh, we know where the vehicles are, and make better decisions for traffic management. And specifically, the work that we're doing with Maricopa County DOT and Arizona DOT is with traffic signals and ramp meters. So we're listening to the connected vehicles as they drive around, and then we decide we can adapt the signal timing to give better timing and better service to the vehicles. You wouldn't have to wait if there's no other cars coming on the other approaches, for example. And then specifically, we're developing, using the connected vehicle technology to develop priority system for special classes of vehicles, like emergency vehicles, transit vehicles, trucks, maybe electric vehicles or you know, energy-efficient vehicles.
Is the main goal here safety?
Yeah, the number one goal is safety. But on top of safety, we can improve mobility, and we can improve the environment. I can give you an example of environmental improvement. Is we're looking at a project in Maricopa County on MC-85, and there's a lot of warehouses and factories there. And if the trucks were equipped with these devices that we put in cars for testing and could send requests to the traffic signals, then we could move them through the signals without them having to stop and accelerate. If they don't accelerate, they don't generate nearly as much pollution. If they don't stop, they don't tear the pavement up.
How prevalent is this device in cars that are currently on the road?
Well, that's the real exciting part, is the NHTSA, which is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, is right on the verge of passing a rule that every new car manufactured in the U.S. will be required to have one of these devices. The first car to come off the production line with the technology will be the 2017 Cadillac CTS. So next year, midsummer, you should start seeing cars come off the line that have these devices in them. And then, of course, Toyota and Honda and others are following right in behind.
In order for the system to really work, do you have a sense of what percentage of cars would need to have this in them? Because it obviously takes a long time to sort of cycle through everybody who has a car to get a newer one that would have this in it. Then you also have, historic cars and, as you said earlier, trucks and other types of vehicles in them.
Yeah, so that's a really good question, because in the safety realm, if you don't have two equipped vehicles encounter each other, then there's no benefit. So you need the market penetration rate to be up high enough so that enough of the safety encounters have equipped cars. That number for safety is probably in the 20 to 30% range. On the traffic signal side and on the traffic management side, we can see benefits a lot earlier. Even if 1 or 2 or 3% of the vehicles are equipped, we get to measure or observe the performance measures of the cars moving. And from that data, we can notice, look, this traffic signal has a lot of delay on this left turn. This is the first time in the industry that we've had the fidelity of data to really do performance assessment by movement, by mode. And so that's one of the really exciting parts.
Even with all this data, though, am I right that you still need the people who are behind the wheels to be paying attention and doing their best to keep themselves and the people around them safe?
Right. And so we need drivers to be more aware. Several ways that we can do that is by in the vehicles having better situational awareness data. If you buy a new car now, you'll get lane keeping data. You'll get all kinds of information about what's going on around you from your sensors, blind spot sensors and such. Now with connected vehicle data, it's not just the car that you can sense in front of you. It's several cars down the road. When it hits its brakes, you could receive information about that, and your car can react in a better manner.
Larry Head is a systems and industrial engineering professor at the University of Arizona. We are talking about his work on connected vehicle technology here in Arizona. Larry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
Pop-up galleries and artists moving from site to site are becoming more common in the Valley. Brothers Gabriel and Isaac Fortuil describe themselves as nomadic in the art realm. They came to Phoenix in 2002 from New Jersey. The attacks of 9/11 were the significant factor in pushing them to try something and someplace new. They stayed for a few years before leaving. Then they returned with an exhibition in 2014 and are now using a gallery space at 815 North Central Avenue for their latest installation. It's called Fortuil Brothers Phoenix, and Gabriel Fortuil is with me now. Gabriel, how did these shows come about?
We find some inspiration or draw to a city or a place. Once we have that feeling where, we're inspired to create a body of work, the next step would be to find, the proper vessel for the exhibition. And sometimes it actually is an actual space that becomes the inspiration. So, at the moment, we really enjoy doing this sort of nomadic exhibitions in different cities and states, and we plan on bringing it to other countries as well.
What have you seen about the art scene here that has changed since, whether it's 2002 or 2006 or 7? A lot of people are saying it's growing. Is it just that people who are not on the inside are seeing more of it, and so it feels like it's grown?
The major difference for me is that people who don't live downtown are more comfortable coming downtown. And that now exposes them to different forms of art that maybe they weren't familiar with before or they weren't necessarily comfortable with. But, there's definitely has been that return to the urban areas in Phoenix and many other cities, away from the suburbs and downtown is very small, and you know, if you compare it to New York City or other major cities, but it still has that same sort of energy, which is kind of a melting pot of different people and different cultures, different businesses, and the fact that you're forced to interact with people.
You know what struck me when you said people more comfortable maybe with the art, or at least with the area? Are you looking for there to be a little bit of, maybe discomfort's the wrong word, but a little bit of uncertainty or something?
I would like to think that we are presenting something to them that maybe they haven't seen before. So not that it has never appeared in their life before, but it's something maybe they've forgotten about, or maybe they just take for granted. And these would be like, you know, the small details of life that as a youth, as a child, we see everything and we absorb everything, and everything is magic. Everything is just amazing and beautiful. And as time passes and we learn things and, you know, we get into our routines and we have other things that take on more significance, we forget, you know, a lot of that. And I think if we can refine those pure moments, that those will help solve a lot of the questions and issues that we deal with.
In this place in Phoenix, does it make more sense to have flexibility as it relates to the spaces you use, especially because this is a growing community? It's not quite as established. Does it make sense to be able to float a little bit, I guess?
You have to have some consistency, because, you know, if people are hearing about a space or the artwork that happens in the space, you know, it's definitely easier for them to find it if you're more stable in one position. But even when we were just getting started down here, like, fortunately, we were able to use many different spaces because, you know, it is a tight-knit community. And if people were attracted to what we were doing, they would offer spaces. And it just presents a new challenge to us. It provides new inspiration. Like, it's amazing, and you can get attached to something and be very comfortable. But for us, you know, that's not what we need or what we want. I think we need, like, a little instability just to kind of get the juices flowing again.
After 9/11, was there a, how did you end up going that timing from New Jersey to Phoenix?
Really, it started the summer before. I was working in New York City, and I was working on Wall Street, and I was a stockbroker, and I was searching for my passion, and I was a little confused, and, you know, I was really looking for the meaning of my life. But then 9/11 happened, and, you know, you see something like that firsthand, and you just feel this such a heavy, like, yeah, energy, and just, like, I got to see the people as they were coming across the ferry covered in soot. Like, I was, you know, I saw that. And I, you know, I commuted into Lower Manhattan for about 4 years through the World Trade Center. And I had just transferred over to Jersey City like 6 months prior. So, yeah, you see something like that, it marks you in many different ways. And it wasn't about being scared of what may come in New York City, like, you know, the potential for further disaster, whatever the cause of it was. But it's definitely, you know, it's a sign, you know, like, maybe you need some change, like, this, you know, just go.
That's Gabriel Fortul. He and his brother Isaac have a new pop-up gallery in Central Phoenix that's part of Third Friday.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.